Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. I have SMA Type 2, and I am a columnist and forums director for SMANewsToday.com. Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast, episode 90. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Today on the show, we have a very special guest with us, a pioneer of the disability rights movement. She is one of the primary subjects of the 2020 Netflix documentary, Crip Camp. In the United States, she served in the administrations of Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. And in 2020, she published her memoir, Being Human, an unrepentant memoir of a disability rights activist. I am delighted to welcome Judy Heumann. Judy, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Absolutely. I am very much looking forward to talk with you. And before we get started, if everyone could please listen to a brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast was brought to you by Genentech, the makers of an FDA-approved treatment for SMA. To learn about our study results across different types of people with SMA, visit approvedforsma.com. That's approvedforsma.com.
Okay. Well, Judy, to start off, so you wrote in your book, which I had the chance to read this summer, you wrote about your childhood and how you had a very early exposure to the larger disability community. I want to ask, what were some of your biggest takeaways at that time interacting with other disabled peers?
So yeah, the book Being Human, I have two books out now. Mm-hmm. The first one, as you mentioned, is called Being Human. And I wrote it in collaboration with a woman named Kristen Joyner. And then this past June, 2021, we came out with a young adult version called Rolling Warrior. And both of the books can be gotten at local bookstores, libraries, Amazon, and they're also out on audio. And the audio books are read by a woman named Allie Stroker. And Allie played on Broadway, and she also won an award for her performance in Oklahoma. So the book itself, when talking about my earlier parts of my life, I'm 73 now, I started meeting other disabled children when I finally was able to go into a school building, but my classes were only with disabled children. And so at that time, the majority, vast majority of the children in the classes that I went to had cerebral palsy. And you know, I think SMA as an example, when did the term SMA first start to be used?
It was, I was diagnosed in 95. By then it had been used. I think it was around 80s or 90s when it officially came into
yeah. Term. So I had a very dear friend named Frida Tankis, who had a form of muscular dystrophy, who unfortunately passed away in the early 70s. But she and a number of people, Frida is seen in Crip Camp. And then as you see in Crip Camp, people like Stevie Hoffman and Nancy Rosenblum, two of the other people that were highlighted, and Neil Jacobson, all had cerebral palsy. And they were all in my class. And Denise Jacobson lived in the Bronx. And so we didn't know her at that point when I was in elementary school. But you know, at the age of 9, I didn't think about a movement at all, mm-hmm. right? It was just people that I knew at that point in my life were mainly non-disabled individuals. And so being able to meet other disabled people who I met every day while the learning that was going on was really very subpar, it was a great opportunity to be able to become friends with other people who were like me and to be able to recognize that there was a, especially as we got older, a qualitatively different experience when talking with other disabled people about some of the experiences we were having. I always need to underscore the fact that I think segregated education is not good. And it's nothing that I think, I guess the most valuable part of that education was meeting other disabled people. And that's something that we can continue to talk about here. But I think really for me, those friendships, Frida, another friend, Linda Katz, who also had some form of muscular dystrophy, and others, learning that there were people who had cerebral palsy, spina bifida, muscular dystrophy, polio, and other forms of disabilities was also very valuable because it allowed me to begin to just think in a more expansive way, both about our disabilities and how they affected us, but also looking at the types of things that we needed that were in common, you know, like technology, wheelchairs, curb cuts, ramps, bathroom doors, assistance in doing basic things, especially as we were getting older and we're very dependent on our parents to help us do things that our siblings or friends were able to do independently. You know, getting dressed, getting undressed, picking out your clothes, going shopping, all those types of things. So I think the value for me really very much was planting multiple seeds at a reasonably young age, recognizing that we had common problems and that our solutions, our vision of our solutions were pretty common.
Right, right. Well, and on that note too, Camp Jened was a foundational part of your life and many other disability activists as depicted in the Crip Camp film, which if listeners have not seen, I totally recommend you go watch it as soon as you can. We actually did an episode on it last year. When you were a camper there, Judy, did you have though a feeling or an inclination that the community there would become something bigger?
So first of all, Camp Jened was not the first camp I went to.
Okay.
I don't know, in North Carolina, did you go to camp?
I went to MDA camp 1 year, yes. Yeah.
Okay. So I went to a camp called Camp Oakhurst out of New Jersey, which actually is still around. Unfortunately, Camp Jened is not. Mm-hmm. But so my first camping experience for a couple of years was at Camp Oakhurst in New Jersey. I think one of the reasons why I switched to Camp Jened, and both of my parents are deceased, so I actually don't know the actual reason, but I think it was because there was longer seasons at Camp Jened. So you could go to Camp Jened for up to 8 weeks, but for Camp Oakhurst, you could only go for 3 weeks. So did I realize that our camp experiences and our school experiences were going to give birth to a movement? Not really, because I was still too young. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, as we got older and were able to really have a broader impact, because this examples that I was giving earlier of meeting people that kept expanding. So Oakhurst, Jened, then I went to a regular high school that had special ed homerooms and transportation. So not a high school in my neighborhood at all. But there I was meeting other disabled people with different types of disabilities. And the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement were really becoming much more prominent at that point in time, 50s and 60s on forward. So I think when we finally started this organization in New York called Disabled in Action, those of us who were involved with it, at this point, we were in college and we were at different universities, Long Island University, NYU, Brooklyn College, Hunter, other schools, Long Island, Hofstra. I think we were really thinking about how what we were doing was different than what we had seen in other organizations. Because remember, at that time, Jerry Lewis was the symbol for MBAA. And every year, he would have these 24-hour telethons, which were really antithetical to what we were moving forward with. And actually, when we started Disabled in Action in Brooklyn, although it wasn't limited to Brooklyn, but its members were from New York City primarily, there was a guy named Jimmy Lynch who had some form of muscular dystrophy. He was on the board for Disabled in Action. And he also led a hunger strike. He and another person sat outside the MDA telethon and had a hunger strike protesting the Jerry Lewis telethon. And that certainly was the first time that anything like that happened. And DIA had many different committees. We had an anti-sheltered workshop committee, a committee working on inclusive education, on employment, on many different things. So really at that point, we definitely were seeing ourselves as forming an organization that would be cross disability for that time, and was really looking much more comprehensively, not just at a particular issue, but really looking more holistically. And I think really looking at the need for systemic change, engagement with legislators. Now in New York City, there were other organizations, groups like the Eastern Paralyzed Veterans Association. There was a mayor's office on disability, United Cerebral Palsy, and many other groups, but many of those organizations were not led by disabled people. And that was one of the big shifts that was going on college campuses across the United States, where although the staff were frequently not disabled people, in some places like at Berkeley, the director was disabled and they had disabled people on their staff. So you really saw this beginning articulation publicly about the need for the voices of disabled people to be dominant. And I think we really were looking at the issue of the role of parents. And, you know, very much, I think to a person, you know, we all talked about the important role our parents played, but our parents also very much were seeing that their voices needed to change. Mm-hmm. Being very strong advocates for us to get into school and to do what they needed to do to help us be on the path for a more successful life. They really understood that it was much more believable when it was disabled people who were impacted by discrimination to be the significant people speaking.
Right, right. Well, and one of the most striking parts of watching Crip Camp for me was seeing those images of the institutions of that time. And I know for you, like, what I can't imagine what it was like meeting people at camp who had come from those institutions. And, you know, I mean, I think you had obviously experienced ableism and you talked about your parents fighting to get you into school. But what was that realization like of learning that peers you were with had come from these horrible institutions that were at the epitome of dehumanizing disabled individuals?
There was like one person who had come from an institution, Willowbrook. But I got involved with Willowbrook because Disabled in Action, there was an announcement in the New York Times that there was going to be a meeting at Willowbrook of parents and people who worked at Willowbrook to set up an organization to basically fight against what was going on at Willowbrook. And so we sent a woman by the name of Bobby Lynn to that meeting. She had cerebral palsy and she could walk, and so she could get to Staten Island. So she went to the meeting and we began to form a close relationship with this group. And if you look at Crip Camp and you see the footage of the demonstrations on Madison Avenue, a number of the people there were from Willowbrook. Not people yet who themselves lived in Willowbrook, but people who worked, had kids in Willowbrook. I visited Willowbrook, and that was really the first time that I physically had been at an institution. I'd seen, you know, little bits and pieces on TV when Geraldo Rivera, who is the gentleman who got the keys and was able to get in to some of the buildings at Willowbrook, but actually being there myself was much more powerful. They were actually not going to let me on the site. I went with a reporter from Staten Island newspaper and a nun, and they were not going to let me on the property because I used a wheelchair. And so then, it's so ironic, Kevin, you know, they knew why we were there. And so they ultimately wanted me to sign a paper that if anything happened to me, it wasn't their responsibility. And of course they didn't ask the reporter or the nun to sign that paper. And I can't remember if I ultimately signed it just so I could get in. But anyway, the whole thing was, the entrance to it really epitomized the overall problem. And, you know, when we were there, it was, you know, seeing something like that and, you know, engaging with people who were living there, it's very overwhelming, because what really was going on was exactly what the Rivera footage showed. They were understaffed. There was little, if anything, going on, even though by the time we were visiting, it was a number of months after the whole scandal had broken. And so I would say probably the main difference was that people had clothing on, but there were babies laying off mats on the floor, staff sitting around in chairs, television on, no interaction going on. And then there was this big room with many people who were laying in what I would call Liza Doolittle floral boxes, if you've seen My Fair Lady, and she had this cart, and there were individual people sitting in these carts or in a rocking chair. And then we went to one building, which was completely different. It was small, and there were people in the building. I don't know how they got assigned. Their disabilities were less significant than people in the other buildings, but they still had significant disabilities. But it was a really beautiful room. They had plants and everybody was dressed. And I mean, they were sharing a big room, so that in and of itself was a problem. But it was like a night and day on the same premises. So the overall experience was very empowering.
I imagine, really, yeah.
Justice right in front of your face.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, like I said, it was definitely one of the most difficult to watch, but so enlightening parts of watching the documentary. Judy, before we go on, if everyone could please listen to one more brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast is made possible by a sponsorship from Genentech. Are you living with SMA, or are you a caregiver for someone who is? A treatment has been FDA approved based on studies of different types of people living with SMA. Genentech extends a special thanks to all the individuals, families, and healthcare providers who participated in the studies that led to making this treatment option a reality. To learn more about this treatment, visit approvedforsma.com.
Okay, and so Judy, continuing on this conversation, in both your book and in Crypt Camp, you give readers and viewers an insight into the sacrifices that you and other activists made during the 504 sit-ins. And many of you went without food and water and basic necessities for days, knowing that this was an essential law to fight for. And what I want to ask here is, thinking about those things that you endured, what would you say to people today who say things like wearing a mask is their greatest inconvenience?
So I think, great question. So I believe, you know, what went on in the building, and for the listeners who haven't seen Crypt Camp, there was a demonstration in San Francisco, which resulted in about 150 people entering a federal building and staying there for 26 days. And I think, you know, we all felt that what we were doing was really for the betterment of the entire country by fighting to get regulations for this law called Section 504, which prohibits discrimination against disabled people if the entity is getting money from the federal government. I think it's very unfortunate and tragic, really, that people are not wearing masks and are not getting vaccinated. I mean, I had polio, and so the vaccine came out in 1961, and I had polio in 1949. Now, it's always a little bit of a difficult discussion because, you know, I have polio, I'm a very proud disability rights activist, but I don't say to people, don't get the polio vaccine because you could get polio like me. And I think what's going on right now is tragic because there's so many people dying. And I think we're saying now that there are about 10 million people who have what's beginning to be called long COVID. And I think the similarity between COVID and polio is interesting. I'm not talking about the viruses, and I don't know anything about the commonality or not. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm saying is that people who had polio, some people died, some people wound up using an iron lung or other forms of breathing equipment for the rest of their lives. People like Ed Roberts, a very strong disability rights advocate in the United States, and he had polio, I guess, in the early 1960s. So just around when the vaccine was coming out more, and he obviously didn't have it. And he used a ventilator his whole life and wound up being able to use one finger and one toe. Now, then there were other people who had it, but it didn't really start having an impact on them for years down the road. And so I think that's what we're looking at with long COVID. We really don't know the long-term effect, but we are seeing already that there are people who are having longer effects from the virus and now the variants. And so I presume that most of the people listening to this program have taken the vaccine. But if there are people who haven't, I think in a non-threatening way, it's really important to allow people to see the weaknesses in our systems that make it more difficult for us as disabled people to be able to move forward in life. And we encourage them to both get the vaccine, but certainly using a mask, because they're putting all of us who have disabilities at greater risk of getting the COVID variant, which will not be as bad as if we hadn't had our vaccines. But at the end of the day, I think we have a responsibility to ourselves and our family and our community. With the numbers going up of people who are being infected, where like 95, 97% of the people who are dying are people who didn't have the vaccine, you have to really kind of pray that someone helps them see the light.
Oh, very well said. I mean, it's just, It's crazy times we're living in, and thank you for giving your perspective on that.
But I think it's really a time to depoliticize an issue like this.
Right.
And I know it's difficult because things have become so politicized over the last number of years, and I've got very strong political views. But on this, I think we need to put all that to the side and really look at ourselves individually and hoping that you want to be around.
Absolutely. I totally agree there. But, and Judy, switching subjects a little bit, but another thing you wrote about in your book was your relationship with your husband, who also is disabled. And I was wondering, can you talk a little bit about that, just about the nuances of having a marriage where both partners are disabled?
Yeah, so we both have disabilities. When he came, he's from Mexico. And so it's blending of families. I have, compared to his family, very small. I have two brothers. He has five surviving sisters and brothers. One sister passed away many years ago, and we have like 13 nieces and nephews and 10 grand nieces and nephews and more on the way. So I think it's been because we both use wheelchairs. It's been, you know, really being able to be supportive of each other as we move forward. And, you know, as, you know, he's gotten older, he's needed more assistance than he did when I first met him. So, you know, we're also dealing with the challenges of personal assistance services and things like that. But I think in some way it makes our relationship stronger. And certainly, you know, he's got a great family. So it's been great for me to get caught up in a much bigger community of people that are very loving and supportive of each other.
That's really cool. Yeah. It's something like I know in Crip Camp, there was a couple, was it Neil and I forget his wife's name.
Denise.
Yes. And they talked about that as well. I mean, they both met as teenagers and then both have cerebral palsy. It's always fascinating to look at relationships like that, that I feel like, you know, the world outside of our community might be like, oh, how would that work? And may think of it in a negative context when really it's something beautiful. Like you said, when you have that kind of interdependence and it can in many ways enhance your relationship, I think.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And also you mentioned Ali Stroker earlier. So I know this story came out a few months ago, but there is talks of making a movie out of your book, and there's a strong possibility that she might play you. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So we have a deal with Apple, and I believe Ali will be playing me.
That's awesome. And what is that like, just to know that not only today is there a studio interested in telling your story, but also to have a disabled actress play you?
I mean, I think what's important about this is not just this film, but that there has been for more than 20 years, a growing number of disabled people who are professionals across the industry, and others who have really been banging on the doors of filmmakers, TV makers, Broadway producers, et cetera, to both have disabled people playing, you know, our own roles. But I think equally important that disabled people are being hired across the board in all positions. So there is a growing support, I think, from more of the companies, production companies, to recognize that disabled people and our issues need to be more central to work that's being done. Saying that, I don't want to overblow what's happening yet. I think there are a number of organizations. There's one, the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, which has a project called DMAP, the Disability Media Alliance Project. And I'm working with Jedef on that project. Lawrence Carter Long is one of the leaders in that, and Kara Reedy, who's a journalist, and both of them have disabilities. We're working with other journalists who have disabilities to set up an organization for disabled journalists, as well as consulting with many different companies that are working on the inclusion of disability. And then there's also an organization which came about that's being run by Andrea Levant Consulting. And Andrea also, I'm not sure if she has SMA. I think she might actually. She has been the one that's been heading up the Crip Camp activities over the last year. And you're working with companies and others on inclusion of disability. And then there's another group called Forward Doc. And Forward Doc is an organization made up of disabled people in documentary filmmaking. And so we're seeing really increasing numbers of organizations and disabled people coming forward. This show, this your program will probably come on after the Emmys, but there's a big push going on right now to get the Emmys to make their stage accessible. And I'm not sure what's going to happen this year, but I would bet that if it doesn't happen the right way this year, it will henceforth. Because I think, you know, what's very important is that everybody listening to this program, not just today, but in general, we need to have our voices much more prominently out there. We need to be seen as customers of, you know, television, radio, all kinds of filmmaking, et cetera, as well as people who need to be employed in these industries. And we need to make the number 60 million disabled people mean something in the United States in a much more forthright way.
I totally agree. I mean, you mentioned the Emmys thing, and I know the Oscars this year, since Crip Camp was nominated for Best Documentary, the stage was finally accessible there. And it seems like, I mean, it's such a small yet big step there, because it's something that wasn't even thought about for all these years. And now they're kind of forced
to. The way they thought about it is, do we have a nominee who's going to need to use a ramp? Mm-hmm. Which is, of course, illegal.
Yeah.
And let's be careful on what we say about the Oscars.
Yeah.
They were not in their main building.
Right. That's true.
Yeah. So I don't want to take credit away from them, because they did a very nice job. Mm-hmm. It was... the Oscars were held this year in their train station, and they did a beautiful job of everything, including the stage. So kudos to them for having complied with the law. So that's why I'm really careful about, am I giving them a kudo because they've done what they've legally been responsible to do for more than 20 years? I don't want that to be with people here, but they finally did it, and they did a very nice job, which they definitely do deserve credit for.
That's great. No, it's, well, like you said, I think it's just a matter of like companies and organizations moving in the right step, even with past faults. You know, it's where do we go from here? And on that note too, so in reading your book and learning about your story about how your parents fought long and hard to get you into public school, it reminded me of an incident from my childhood, which my parents told me about years later. But when I was in preschool, the school system tried to put me in a special education class as well, despite the fact that my disability did not affect my cognitive abilities. And my mom fought and eventually got me into a standard classroom. But this is just one example of how ableism remains rampant in our society. And I mean, I'm much younger. I was born in 93. But just to know, like, it's kind of crazy, you know, that something like that was still happening decades later from your childhood. And on that note, Judy, so what message do you have for listeners about the progress that's been made and the work that's still to come in the realm of disability rights?
So let me divide this up. First, let me say that children with cognitive disabilities don't belong in segregated schools or segregated classes any more than kids with physical disabilities or learning disabilities, autism, whatever it may be. We all belong in programs that are as inclusive as possible. And I think that's really important for parents to really recognize that, and gets to your question, which is where are we today compared to where we were pre-ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, pre-Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, pre-Section 504, on and on. I think there's no doubt that we are much further ahead. In saying that, the road that we need to travel down to really be fully included, we're not there yet. And when you think about the intersectionality of disabled people, so disabled people who are Black or Brown, Indigenous, LGBTQ, those and other religious minorities, etc. So we're talking about disabled people plus all of the other aspects of a person's life that could make disability one of many other characteristics that one has that is resulting in segregation, inferior healthcare, inferior education, housing, on and on. So we have a lot of complexity in our community, more than most other communities. And one of the important aspects of what is going on is that the movement itself is also not only expanding to be more cross disability, but also the voices of people from other, for people of color and other marginalized populations. Those voices are also coming forward in a more prominent way. And I think all that's important. The SMA community goes without saying, like for people with polio, like myself, we need personal assistance. And you and I were discussing earlier how we both use personal assistance and when changes happen, how it kind of throws our lives up in the air, looking for people who are gonna be not only qualified to do the work, quote unquote, but also people that we get along with that kind of fit into family life. There's so many variables and it's difficult. It's always been difficult, but I think it's more difficult now. And I think it's another reason why we need to really be looking as a community. And now I'm not just talking disabled people, but the broader community, because people wish to age in place. But in order to age in place, if you don't have a disability today, you may well need personal assistance in your home so that you don't wind up having to be in a nursing home, of which we only hear daily terrible things, on and on. So we need to continue to educate people about how disability is a normal, valuable part of life, and how being more collaborative in the end can really help many other people who don't see themselves as having a disability, as being able to work in conjunction with us, to be able to support, like President Biden's initiative of $400 billion in personal assistance services, which I'm very concerned is going to be reduced because of issues going on right now in the Congress and people not understanding the importance of it. Now it not only creates jobs for the person doing the work, but it also allows people like us to continue to work. So it's got a multiplier effect.
Absolutely. I think you said it so articulately there, but Judy, thank you so much. This has been a fantastic conversation. I think we could talk all day, but I don't know, is there any other message you want to say? Or I obviously, I know, you know, people can find your books on Amazon. anywhere else people can find you.
Local bookstores.
Yes. They I got my copy from an indie bookstore this summer, which was really nice. So yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's just, if you have children and you're a parent of a child with SMA, meet adults with SMA, have your kids meet adults with SMA, allow your children to become adults who see themselves as having a future of their choosing, but also recognizing that discrimination is still here, and allowing your children to meet other people like Kevin and many others who can really be good mentors for people is very important, and take the role as parents that you would be taking for your non-disabled children. There's a certain role you play when they're younger, and as they get older, you play a different role. It might be difficult, but nonetheless, that's kind of the way it goes. So thank you so much, Kevin. This has been great.
Oh, thank you. This has been an absolute pleasure. And for our listeners out there, you can hear more stories and conversations like this by subscribing to the SMA News Today podcast. You can also connect with us directly on our forums and follow our main website at smanewstoday.com for the latest SMA news and perspectives. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time. Take care.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.smanewstoday.com, and be sure to follow us on social media and join our SMA News Today forums, a trusted SMA community ready to welcome you anytime.